This podcast is sponsored by Athletic Greens. Now, I'm sure you've heard of Athletic Greens from 1,000 different other podcasts, but the reason why I think this is the case is because it works. I've been using it for years, and the biggest benefits that I've realized is that it gives me more energy. I feel like I'm getting a full and healthy diet. My poops are better, and I'm sorry to say, but it's true. And so if you're somebody who really wants a healthy diet where they're confident they're getting all their micronutrients, go on and head over to drinkag1.com/Farzad. drinkag1.com/Farzad, where you'll get a free vitamin D plus K2 bottle and 5 free travel packs. Thank you so much to Athletic Greens. And now onto the podcast.
I feel like the economy is not in a good spot at all. I just don't have a lot of confidence that the end of this year is going to be good, even with the Fed lowering rates, because I think all that's going to do is just increase inflation. People ain't buying new cars. Why? Because they can't afford it. Because they can't afford it.
So what you're saying is Tesla has a demand problem.
Yes. Yeah, they do. Maybe that's not fair. Let's go. He's got an unfair advantage. He got shot at.
Is that what Elon's doing wrong? He's not letting any of his would-be assassins shoot at him.
Jeez, that's so dark.
Of course that power is going to be abused. Like, what, you think that you're going to give them, you know, social media nukes and expect them not to use them? Come on. From time to time, the Tree of Liberty must be refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants.
Like, all the signals that are coming through, I don't know if you agree, but I feel like all the signals that are coming through, not just about the economy, well, I guess about the economy, but especially the auto industry. I don't know how closely you've been following it, but it's just not, I don't know. I don't have a lot of confidence that it's going to be in a good spot by the end of the year. This is inflation. So it's come down quite a bit since the peak, but it's still not back to pre-COVID levels.
So anyways, if you do the math on those numbers, assuming that they're correct, or who knows, but 1.81 plus 1.23 plus 4.7 plus 8 plus 4.1, and then I did plus 1.5 since we're only halfway through 2024 instead of the full three, that gets us to 21.34% total inflation from pre-COVID to today. So basically, for every dollar that you spend, you have 80 cents worth of purchasing power, a little bit less than you had 5 years ago.
Crazy. And, you know, the thing about inflation, you know, it's when I talk to people that don't follow this very closely in real life, not in this fake world of online that we live in a lot of, but like in the real world, the inflation is always misunderstood because, you know, sometimes here, well, inflation is down, so the economy is in a good spot. It's like, well, no, the amount by how much your money is losing value has come down, but it's still losing value, right? It's just not at 9% or 8% year over year. It's at 3% year over year, which is more than 50% what it was before COVID, right? Yeah. And the more concerning thing for me, as I'm thinking about like that piece, is if we look at some of the economic data that has come out, you know, just to be like super upfront here, I'm not an economist. I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about, as is tradition with basically everything else on this channel.
We're just clueless.
Yeah, exactly. So if I look at, let me show you some FRET data that I've been looking at. So the Bank of America just put out a study. Oh, here it is. From Unusual Whales, which is a great account to follow for those that are interested. So, breaking, American credit card debt has reached a new all-time high of $1.14 trillion. Approximately 7.18% of credit card users fell behind on their payment in Q2 2024, according to the report, an increase of over 2% from the previous quarter. Now, what's interesting is I can go to the FRED website, which is the Federal Reserve Economic Data website. It's actually a very helpful website for people to sort of keep track of macro stuff that's happening in the U.S. economy. And if I go ahead and I share my screen for that, if I'm looking at large bank consumer credit card balances, which is basically a proxy for what was reported by unusual whales. So this is basically how much credit card balances are out there, like how big they are for the last, call it, 10 years or so. And so pre-COVID credit card balances, all large bank consumer credit card, so this plus the small bank is the total that was reported by unusual whales. So larger bank is about $900 billion-ish. So the pre-COVID top was $773 billion of credit card debt. And then now we're somewhere in the $881 to $911 billion in large bank consumer credit card debt. But if you look at the unusual whales data, that totals up the large and small, right? So huge jump pre-COVID. It's more than 30-35%. So there's a lot more people taking out debt, right? And then I look at savings. So personal savings, and I look at how much there is out there actually of savings in people's bank account. And if I do this graph from, say, 2013, to 2023, just so we have a little bit of a tighter range. So pre-COVID, there was about $1.2 billion of savings in, sorry, no, $1.2 trillion of savings in people's bank accounts pre-COVID. Now it's down to $724 billion, but that's not adjusting for inflation, right? So personal savings, yeah, like how much money have people have in the bank, is down by about 30% versus COVID, on top of 20% inflation, which basically makes that number about half-ish, right? So there is 30 to 40% more credit card debt, and there is 50% less money in people's bank accounts versus pre-COVID. And then the other thing that I looked at...
Well, you do have to inflation adjust the credit card debt as well, which would bring it down from, you know, 30%
to 10%.
10, 15% more, yeah.
Fair enough. But I think that the bigger number, that's a great call out. But I think that the crazy thing to think about there, though, is if we look at that savings, right, the savings number, if you inflation adjust that, then that implies that the delta between savings and credit card has widened quite a bit. Like people do not have nearly as much money in their bank account relative to how much debt they're taking out, which means most of the money is going towards credit cards. And if I show you another graph here, so this is savings rate. So what percentage of essentially disposable income is going to pay off into people's bank accounts? So 2013, January 1st, let's say. Okay, 2013, there we go. The savings rate is about 3.5%. So about 3.5% of someone's paycheck, call it, net taxes, is going to their savings account, whereas before COVID was somewhere around 7%. Okay, so bank account, savings accounts have halved, essentially, if you adjust for inflation. The rate at which people are saving has halved, and credit card balances are at all-time high. 10 to 15% higher than before. So people are spending a lot more on credit. They're saving a lot less. They have less savings. And then on top of that, you have a growing unemployment number, right? If you adjust the employment figures from the United States, like that they're reporting, and you remove any jobs that are being added through, say, government, right? Government jobs that are being created, the economy is actually shedding jobs, not gaining jobs, right? And then on top of that, if we look at a data point from the auto market, which Jeff Lutz, who's a fantastic resource as it pertains to electric vehicles, understanding macro movements, he posted this yesterday, and he's tracking, and I haven't looked at this number in a minute, okay? I was freaking mind blown. I was like, I can't believe this is actually a real number, but it's very much a real number. So it was tracking how the auto market was performing, because people are saying, oh, Tesla's, you know, blah, 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 is their sales are down. Okay. They are down relative to previous year. But if you look at the entire auto market, so 100 days on hand supply in the United States in July, not just for electric vehicles, all vehicle types. Okay. And this is what this graph shows. So this is what he's highlighted here. This dotted line is basically 2024 numbers. And it starts the first week of 2024 all the way to call the 30th week of 2024. And then the other lines are the previous year. So yellow is 2023, red is 2022. So what he's calling out here is if you look at the last 5 years or so, the amount of on hand of new cars in dealers' lots is at an all-time high in the last 5 years, okay? So not all-time high, local high, okay? So it's very, very high. It ended at about 100 days on hand. These automakers want to be somewhere around 60, right around here, okay? But instead, they're at over 100. So what does this mean? People ain't buying new cars. Why? Because they can't afford it. Because they can't afford it. Prices are too high because of inflation. They don't got money in the savings account to pay for one. They have too much credit card balances already to try to carry that. There's more and more people losing their jobs relative to how many jobs are being added in the private sector, okay? So I don't know. And so all of this is to say is like, I feel like the economy is not in a good spot at all. And I'm curious to see where this is going to end up at the second half of this year. Because, I don't know, I just don't have a lot of confidence that the end of this year is going to be good, even with the Fed lowering rates, because I think all that's going to do is just increase inflation, to be honest.
So what you're saying is Tesla has a demand problem.
Yes. Yeah, they do. But then you know what's more interesting to think about is like, okay, in a world where Tesla solves for self-driving, right, what does that do to this number? It makes it worse. It makes it way worse because then you remove the incentive for people to want to buy a car that doesn't have self-driving technology. So these numbers that I just spouted out are just going to get worse. And the reason why I use the auto market is because that's one of the indicators for the economy. Like when people are not buying cars, it means that they can't afford large purchases, which means that they're not in a good spot financially, right? And if you also look at housing, it's showing something very similar. Go ahead.
So anyways, I was listening to some commentary by the BG2 podcast, and one of the things that Brad Gerstner was mentioning was that Airbnb data, which is going to be tracking like vacation spending, just basically travel in general, is significantly down. And then both between him and Bill, they were just talking about a number of different signs that were potentially entering into a period where the probability of recession is higher. Not that there's going to be a recession, but the probability of recession is significantly increased right now. That the things that they were looking at were some of those travel related metrics, vacations, you know, things like Disney World, airfares or Airbnbs or hotels or all of these types of things. And that's one of those things that where there's a lot of discretionary spending that consumers have that they can delay. Like once you start getting into the family vacation, that's one of the last things to go in someone's budget. Because people really, obviously they want to live their life and they want to have, the opportunity to make memories with their loved ones. And so the fact that that is taking such a hit at this point in time is also, you know, a very negative indicator when it comes to the state of the economy right now. It's definitely not a good picture for where we're at and where we're headed.
So do you expect the Fed, do you think they're definitely going to cut rates in September? Because I think it was like an 80% chance or something that they're going to cut by at least 0.25, right?
Yeah, I mean, all the commentary definitely sounds like they're going to begin to cut. But remember, the 10-year treasury is already down. And this was something that I didn't realize until, you know, they mentioned this also on the BG2 podcast, that most consumer loans are indexed to the 10-year, not necessarily to the Fed funds rate. And so the 10-year is not necessary, like the 10-year is already priced in these rate cuts. And so there's not going to be an immediate impact on the, you know, our ability to borrow as consumers, whether that's for auto loans or, you know, purchasing homes or, you know, anything that you're going to buy with debt. Those rates have already come down over the past 12 months because these rate cuts were kind of anticipated by the market. And so that's why the 10 years at 4 and some change instead of 5.5. So yes, but whoop-de-doo, like they're coming later, honestly, than expected. And the question, you know, if they get aggressive with them and they go further, well, then that's a different story. But if we see probably a 0.5, then, you know, that's, or, you know, 50 basis points, then that's really what's expected. Less than that would, I think, be seen as overly cautious. More than that would be probably perceived as overly alarmist. And either one of those, you know, if it's not 50 basis points, I think that sends signals to the market that are potentially also something that would cause some volatility as well.
So all to say that this, the second half of this year, I feel like is headed towards a lot of instability, I feel like, from an economic perspective. You know, it just feels a little bit unstable in a lot of different places. And like, you know, this whole narrative that AI is propping up the economy in a way, you know, which we've talked about before on the podcast. Yeah, I don't feel very optimistic about what the economy is going to look like. But I've said that multiple times in the last year and a half, just because like the data was so conflicting. Remember when we had a recession, but it wasn't a recession? Do you remember that little bit of time there where like they completely it's not a recession. Oh, the two back-to-back GDP numbers? No, not a recession.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that was weird.
I mean, I can understand, you know, the argument that was made, if you steel man it, was that after what happened in COVID, like we've never gone through a period of instability like that in modern history. And if that's the case, then you kind of have to, like, it's a recession, but asterisk. Like,
yeah,
we had to do some crazy things. We broke glass in case of emergency. And, you know, I tend to agree with David Sachs on the point that, like, we had to do something. First of all, I think our response to COVID to begin with was insane. Like, there was zero justifiable rationale for completely shutting down the entire economy the way that we did. That was dumb. And at the time, it was also dumb. But the people who had their heads about them were not allowed to have a say in the dumb decisions that were made.
Fair enough.
So that said, okay, once we made that decision, then we had to do something about it. And I think that the most of the damage as far as where we're at with inflation and the recession issues that we are set to face are because we just continued to keep spending well past the point at which, like, we used the excuse of COVID as a, you know, blank check to just spend to oblivion. And now that debt is beginning to come due, and we've only begun really to face that. I mean, with the Fed funds rate where they're at and the amount of national debt that we have, like, this is a situation that has the potential to get worse every year unless we can massively grow GDP. And so, like, over the next decade, either we massively grow GDP and we grow our way out of a hole, or we basically bankrupt the federal government. And, like, it's one or the other.
And what's interesting about, like, grow the economy like crazy, what the overlap there is, in a pretty optimistic scenario, that could actually happen, because if artificial intelligence turns out to be the thing that a lot of us think it can be, it could do that. You know, but we have to have solutions, products, and services that bring a ton of value to society that is worthy of all the costs that we've dumped into those technologies, right? So, like, the whole thing about, you know, the reason why NVIDIA has been performing so well is because freaking everybody's buying an AI chip, but nobody has figured out how to make an ROI on that AI chip yet, right? So there's billions and tens of billions of dollars being invested in artificial intelligence, but we haven't seen an ROI, return on investment on it yet. But that return on investment could be the thing that helps us grow out of this hole, but it has to come to fruition.
and over, you know, it's more like a call option leap than, you know, investing in a security as a long, because it has to happen by a certain point in time. Like we have a limited window in which we have to make some gains in order to keep this situation at bay. And so hopefully it gets here in time. To me, it feels like with ChatGPT and all of these LLM, you know, consumer apps, that we are essentially in the consumer 3D printing phase of the technology. And I don't know that we'll be stuck there forever, but I remember, you know, back in the early 2010s that there was a lot of excitement. I was involved in a lot of that, where getting 3D printers, enjoying them, using them, trying to figure out how to make them a viable consumer product that every person in the United States would have, you know, on their desk, just like they have a computer. And the reality of the situation was, and continues to be today, that while 3D printers were cool and they can do a lot of things, that they don't really have a viable use case for the personal application that scales to large scale. That just like the economics, it's just not worth it to buy them and have them and run them. Like, there's so much cost involved in not only acquiring the thing, but then you have to understand how to use it, and you have to have a whole other set of skills just to create anything that you want. And it takes a lot of time, and it's just easier to outsource all of that to this incredible distributed manufacturing system that we have of Amazon. Like, it's much easier to go on Amazon and find whatever it is that you are going to make with your 3D printer and order it to your house in 2 days or 2 hours in some places than it is to have this silly thing on your desk. You know, maybe eventually that will change, but that does not mean that 3D printing did not work, because it has taken over as the de facto mode of manufacturing for a number of very specific use cases. Rocket engines would be one example, but a number of other things that are manufactured at mass scale. And you see these machines in factories. They're still, you know, they're not necessarily a personal use case technology. They are an industrial technology. And it feels like, for the most part, the actual ROI for LLMs at this point in time is similarly an industrial use case, not a personal use case. That you know, ChatGPT is a toy for 99.9% of people at home, but then there are huge use cases in whether it's doing corporate search on, you know, knowledge bases, or whether you're trying to replace your customer help desk, or, you know, a number of other things. There are viable industrial or you know, commercial business cases that make the spend worth it. And we're just going to have to continue to find those and expand them. And I don't think we're just going to jump from here to everyone uses it all the time, everywhere, in a way that has a profitable business model in any short, like, it's going to be years, I think, before we get there.
So we're screwed.
Assuming that, yeah, we don't get AGI. Well, so that's with the LLMs. The area that I think, you know, it's entirely possible that we have a meaningful addition to GDP from a technology like full self-driving. Like, if we can manufacture in 2026 the 50,000 semis that Elon thinks that we can manufacture, and those semis are capable of driving autonomously, and then we're rolling that forward each year after that, then by 2030, you could have a meaningful fleet of fully electric autonomous semis in the United States. And transportation of goods and services is a huge drag on GDP currently. Like, if you could cut the cost of transport of goods in the United States by, you know, 20, 30, 40%, that in and of itself would be a massive win for US GDP. We need to do that, you know, around the world. And if we're talking about between now and 2035, is that able to make a huge dent in that GDP growth target that we're going to need? I don't know if it's enough on its own, but it definitely gets us part of the way there.
Yeah. It's just, it's, for me, it's hard to see enough positives that will offset the impact of a economy that we've propped up by so much debt, hoping for that, you know, thing to come to fruition. You know, because if you really, we talked about this before, but like debt is like a way to bring the future forward. That if the future doesn't come fast enough in that respect, then it's going to be very, very painful. But this is just a very, very surface level analysis from my end. That kind of, yeah. As I'm thinking about it.
I mean, I think a number of the things really also just involve us getting out of our own way. You know, if you layer on A, we have the ability to do a lot of labor with Optimus over the next 10 to 11 years. That is also very helpful. But another thing is, gosh, if we could just get out of our way on healthcare and massively deregulate, you know, insurance and open up competition, and on healthcare and energy, both. Like, if we could have free market competition in those two areas, which are a huge also portion of spending right now. Like, if you go back 5 years and look at what were healthcare insurance premiums versus today, I'll bet you the increase on that is more than the 20% that it would be just indexed to inflation, which is another factor that destroys consumer spending. And, you know, if we just think from first principles, 100 years from now, it's obvious that everything that we're doing for healthcare right now is going away. Like, we're not going to do even a fraction of the dumb things that we do today for healthcare. And we should be trying to accelerate that future, not delay it. And doing so will be a win for Americans and, you know, people around the world in both health outcomes and cost. Like, that's what technology does. It gives you more for less. And whether it's, you know, providing expert medical advice to people through, you know, this would be a great vertical for a business around LLMs, and I'm sure they're, you know, building these, is, you know, basically a chat doc. That's one thing. But whether it's diagnosis, or if you combine artificial intelligence with all sorts of different medicine, then we can do all sorts of drug discovery and, you know, individually personalized development of cures of, you know, any number of varieties for all kinds of ailments. And if we can knock out cancer, if we can knock out Alzheimer's, if we can knock out diabetes and some of these things, then, you know, those are also huge. You know, if you've got someone like a Steve Jobs, for example, and you can cure him of cancer, what is the effect on global GDP of curing Steve Jobs of cancer and allowing him to live for 30, 40 more years?
Huge. Very good point. And so, like,
and that's
like
just one
compound
guy.
That. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, how many people are in that situation where by keeping alive human capital in essence, right? That will give you excellent ROI on the economy. Like, it's on our best interest to ensure we're doing everything we can to keep people alive for as long as we can, as long as they want to, really.
Yeah, it's not just to put it in exact terms, it's not just a cost that, hey, it costs a lot of money to provide care to people with cancer, but then there is the opportunity cost of all the productivity of that person's life. You know, yeah. Especially if you're talking about someone who comes down with cancer in their 20s or 30s, you're talking about decades and decades worth of productivity. And
that probably peaks at around age 50 or 60, right?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. That's a very interesting way of thinking about that problem. I've always found that I was talking to my father-in-law about this, like the healthcare piece, like the way that's built today, it's the costs associated to it, at least in the United States, I guess, because I can't talk about it. I can barely talk about it in the United States, but it's like, it's so weird how the system is set up to be, because like the thing that I always stuck with healthcare specifically is capitalism to me is the thing that's making it broken today. But capitalism could be the thing that will also fix it long term. You know what I'm saying? Because for-profit healthcare to me removes the correct incentive, which is ensuring that people get fixed or are prevented from being a cost on the system. And instead, capitalism optimizes for how can I keep you alive for as long as possible while giving you all the care that you need, that I think you need to maximize my profits. Right. So the incentive isn't to heal you. The incentive is to keep you alive for as long as possible so that they can sell you stuff.
Yeah, you know? there definitely is that mechanism at play. But then on the flip side, if you just look realistically at both pharmaceuticals and healthcare in general, these are two areas where we have huge costs. But you know what else we have? Huge regulation. Like these are some of the most heavily regulated and government interfered in markets in society. And that contributes at least as much, if not more, to the inefficiencies that exist. Because, you know, when you say that the market wants to keep you alive as long as possible, and while, you know, trying to keep you dependent on whatever it is that they're selling to you so that they can make more money off of you. That is the incentives of one, you know, of any individual participant in a market. But if you have lots of different people who are competing and you can take market share from that guy by providing a cure instead of a, you know, symptom mitigation device, then that is an incentive for someone to come in and destroy that business model. And
so your argument is that we don't have the regulation sort of environment we have today doesn't allow for enough competition to arise to solve for that.
Yes. And part of that is also made worse by a market dynamic that is just how expensive it is to or has been to do a lot of these to develop a lot of these products, whether it's you know, medical devices or whether it is pharmaceuticals. So on the medical device side, the things that make it hard are reliability testing and liability. Like, what happens when, you know, if you're able to save 95 people but your device causes 5 people out of 100 to die, the 5 people that you caused to die out of 100, even though net you provided a benefit to society, that tail risk is that those 5 people can wipe you out as a company. So that makes it hard, and it raises the minimum viable bar of what it takes to provide a service or a product and create a viable business really around that. So that's difficult. And then on the pharmaceutical side, just like the number of things that you have to try in order to find the magical cure that does what you want it to do and doesn't have the unintended consequences that end up being super negative, is just a super grind, super, super difficult. And we haven't had great tools. But that is changing rapidly right now that, you know, with things like AlphaFold, our ability to search the space of possible proteins, the shift over the last really 10 years towards immunotherapies where you're understanding at a deep fundamental first principles way how the human immune system operates, and you're giving it tools to fight things that it didn't understand how to fight well before, and using it like you're cooperating with the human immune system to combat these things, versus just, you know, in the past we would like basically bombard the entire organism with stuff that would try and kill, like you're just trying to kill the disease faster than you kill the person, and hope that there's enough of the person left when you're done, specifically in the case of cancer with things like chemotherapy and radiation, that after the cancer's dead, that you can revive what's left of the patient. And there are a lot of things that kind of operate like that. Yeah. Whereas now, you know, immunotherapies are like, hey, let's teach the body what it looks like to kill this cancer. And once it knows how to do that, then it will just do its job. And there's lots of ways for us to continue on that trend, just using better understanding through science of how our body works, but also better tools of discovery of what are the little, you know, minor tweaks and changes that we can make that allow us to basically conquer these things without having all these side effects. So costs are coming down, you know, costs of research are coming down, costs of discovery are coming down, on not necessarily on the device front, but on the pharmaceutical side, or I guess, yeah.
If sort of we overlap it with what we were talking about before, with the advent of artificial intelligence, that's another area where, you know, the iterations and finding the right protein and all that stuff, that's a thing where AI can help too, right? You would think.
Like, yeah, 100%.
There's just so many different places where this technology can be so incredibly helpful, and that's where. But it's like, but we're still waiting for it. So it's like, is it a function of, it takes time, right? So it's either a function of not enough inference compute, not enough training compute, not enough data, all those different variables. Remember how you laid them out? Like, hey, there's like four or five different ways you can make an AI better. Like, it still feels like we're not there quite yet. And so the way I think about this whole, when can we be there, is I like to think about the benchmark companies and how close they're getting to that thing, to a thing that could correlate to somebody else solving it, and then adding some sort of factor that says this is when everybody else is going to catch up, right? So it's that's how I tend to think about these things, just in a very loose way. So who are some of the leaders in artificial intelligence that you can think of? In the real world is obviously Tesla. In the digital world, you have companies like Anthropic. You have companies like ChatGPT, right? You have Grok and XAI, maybe by the end of this year, early next year. So it's going to be interesting to see, like, once these guys get to a point where, let's say, Tesla solves full self-driving and Tesla is able to offer a robotaxi ride starting late this year, sometime next year, with a full end-to-end neural net AI stack, right? Or Anthropic or ChatGPT or Grok or Gemini or whoever, can offer a some sort of LLM chatbot. But see, I still don't even know. Like, I want to ask you this.
Let me take it in a slightly different direction on some additional things that people may or may not be aware of. So I would say Lemonade is an example of a company that insurance, is using AI to help just improve the business model of insurance. And it's, you know, that's another one where it's taking time, but they are building operating leverage in that business in a very positive way. And if they can continue to do that, you know, driving down the cost of insurance, that's over time, that's a win for GDP. And then I think Palantir is one of the, there's, you know, a number of large leading companies that are employing artificial intelligence to solve large scale commercial problems. Palantir is going to be kind of the Swiss Army knife version of that, that can do a lot of different types of problems. But then there's also lots of vertical companies as well. I can't remember what the name of, like, David Sachs' startup that's doing that for basically an LLM powered version of Slack that, you know, kind of creates a knowledge base. And then David Freeberg has Ohalo that he's building right now that is a company that's using genetic engineering to actually improve potato plants and make them yield significantly more. And so, like, it probably, I think, look at taking the cost of growing potatoes down by 50%. You know, that's a massive global scale. Like, if you can reduce the cost of production of calories by half,
crazy.
And, you know, potatoes are a major source of calories around the world. That's win for just humanity and global GDP all at the same time. Also, but that's, you know, another thing that is made possible by cutting edge breakthroughs in science, but also art. Like, artificial intelligence has been a key input that has made it possible for them to do the science that's necessary to make that happen.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate you bringing those to the forefront. But I guess my point is like, once we start seeing these actually come to fruition, then we know we're getting close to the other stuff. Like, we need that first one to come yet. I think chatbots are not, you know, even though I use ChatGPT and Grok and all these other ones for my work, you know, like, let's say for figuring out titles and concepts and how to think about a certain concept or what are the, you know, like, just creative style things, where in media it's helped me a little bit. I think next year we'll get that first one. Like, that what I'm trying to say is, like, that next year we'll get that first AI product or first AI service where the ROI is painfully obvious.
The killer app.
Exactly. And that is when I think we'll get this in earnest, like an actual boom.
Yeah, I think that's an obvious candidate for what that product is. It's agents as a service. And we're getting much closer to something like that. Hopefully we can get that in the next year. I still don't think even agents as a service, the early versions of that, are going to be as much of a consumer suitable at, like, you know, obviously someone who's got a business that is operating at scale and spending a lot of money to do a thing is going to have way more of a use case for agents as a service to replace costs that they're already spending than someone who's just a person who is, you know, spending a little bit of money here and there on doing that same thing. And they're not going to have that economic, like, no-brainer business case that makes nearly as much sense for them to spend money on an agents as a service. So I think it will still be something that leans more towards the commercial applications than the consumer applications to begin with. But I think that is a huge, you know, once we get those, that's a major, major inflection point in the ROI metric that you're talking about. Like, we'll start getting money, whether it's money saved or money invested or, you know, whatever. There's going to be massive return on investment of agents as long as we have, you know, inference that can operate cheaply enough for them to be able to do that work significantly, you know, for significantly less cost than a human equivalent.
For sure. What topics did you have on your docket that you wanted to hit today? Did you have something specific? Because the other thing I wanted to, like, bring up was the Elon Trump interview next week on Monday. I want to get your thoughts on what you thought was going to happen from that thing.
Yeah, we could talk about that. The only other thing that I have been captivated by over the last 24 hours was just the response. I think it's hilarious.
The UK thing?
Well, I guess there's that too. But then also the people on apparently right-leaning X that are all up in arms about Joe Rogan.
Oh yeah,
RFK,
so which he didn't. By the way, he came out and made a statement that he said he's not endorsing them. Let me pull up the tweet. He said that, isn't that funny, dude? It's the two sides of the same coin. It's incredible. Yeah. It's like it's the same exact thing every freaking year. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or Democrat. The opposite, like the extremes of both parties, are literally exactly the same thing. For the record, This isn't an endorsement. This is Joe Rogan on RFK. This is me saying that I like RFK Jr. as a person, and I really appreciate the way he discusses things with civility and intelligence. I think we could use more of that in this world. I also think Trump raising his fist and saying fight after getting shot is one of the most American fucking things of all time. I'm not the guy to get political information from. If you want that from a comic, go to Comic Dave Smith. He's actually, I like his commentary a lot. I highly recommend him. He's quite the libertarian. If you're libertarian, you'll enjoy his stuff. He actually knows what he's talking about. And I replied and said, you should have Trump and RFK Jr. in your podcast at the same time for a 3-hour discussion. That'd be sick. And Kamala Harris too, if she accepts it. But I don't think.
We all know that's never going to happen.
This is never going to happen. Yeah. Putting politics aside, it's just, there's so many candidates out there, politicians that hate to go off script because they have memorized too many things their donors want to say, and they can't think critically about their positions. Applies to both sides.
I think it's a double whammy. I think that Kamala would be terrified to go into an interview like that. She would see only downsides, no upsides, personally. But beyond what she would or would not like to do, the people that control what she does would never in a million years allow her to do something like that. I mean, this is the exact reason why Joe Biden wasn't even allowed to, you know, participate in the primary, is because the people that are making the decisions are like, fuck no, we're not letting that guy out in front of people to like say things that reveal what's going on behind the curtain here. Like, that's absolutely not allowed. Never, never, never. So,
and yeah, on the other side, Trump wasn't even part of the primaries either. You know, he wasn't part of the debates, really.
Yeah, that is true, but I think for a little bit different reason. And he has shown, while he has not participated in the normal primary process, he has definitely been way out there and, you know, doing all sorts of public speaking and engagements, and basically taking all comers when it comes to those sorts of things, which is not necessarily an endorsement on my part of Trump, but just, it is a different situation than, and that has,
it's unusual for a politician.
Yeah, that has generally been the case for the basically people on the left side of the political spectrum. Like, engaging in intellectual debate with opponents is almost never done. Like, they're very, this is one of the reasons why Destiny, while he's not all that impressive of a person, has such a large following, is because he's one of the only left-leaning people who will actually go discuss any topic with anyone, regardless of how good he is at doing that, because like, there's just no one else that does that. So he kind of by default sucks up, you know, all the audience for that.
Yep. Yeah. I would love it if we had more politicians actually getting in front of long form, let's say, podcast hosts or impartial parties as much as they can be, and just for 2 to 3 hours just talking about the issues. Just talk, like, how do we make the country better? You know, over some tea or coffee. Just literally just like eat and talk about how to make the country better. Like, why can't we do that? Why isn't that standard practice? You know?
I would love to see, you know, somebody like Piers Morgan be the actual host of political debates between, you know, whether that's in the UK or here in the United States. Like, that should be, you know, the de facto way that these conversations get had, because, you know, you cannot have any substantive debate on policy without it being something that is in depth, all out in the open, and, you know, relatively like uncensored. I think that's the good way. Like, you have to be able to explore all sorts raw, of unfiltered area. Yeah. So that would be awesome. Obviously, I don't think we're anywhere close to getting anything like that, other than just, you know, doing it independently of the power structures that exist, and allowing more and more people to spend more and more of their time thinking listening to, engaging with those things.
But I think there is a shift towards that, though, because if you're somebody who follows like the All In pod, Trump was on there. That was an unusual thing. They also had RFK Jr. They had Dean Phillips. They had, who's the guy from Jersey? The big dude. Man, what's his name?
I know who you're talking about. Can't remember his name either.
They had a bunch of different political candidates there that came.
And they've invited Kamala. They invited Biden. And, you know, that's an example where it's like these people are not allowed to participate in that format.
And then you have Lex Fridman, when he interviewed the Neuralink team, when he was talking to Elon, he said that he's going to interview Trump. So I would love to see Lex interview Trump. That's going to be incredible. Elon is interviewing Trump on Monday on X Spaces, which we'll cover on this channel. That is going to be one of the most interesting moments of this of this year. Because it's like, what a weird mashup of two worlds. Like, they both have social media companies, you know? One's got a chaotic, just always on fire social media platform that every time you log on, you're like, what is going on? And then the other one, everything is a truth. Everything's truth. You know, everybody posts truths. And then you got Trump coming on Elon's platform. So that's an interesting little thing there. I wonder how long that's going to be. But I think what's interesting about that conversation, if you put just like politics aside and you just put how you think about each individual aside, is that you have this rare situation where you could have some substantive, high quality sharing of ideas and information on how to make the United States better, regardless of what you think of those positions. At least there's discussion about it in a public forum format. And what I hope happens is that Elon brings up just randos from the crowd to just ask a question or make a comment from all political spectrums, right? Like, that's how it should be. You know, it's like a proper town hall of sorts, you know? And if that is successful, I think that's going to be a huge boon for X long term. Because it kind of proves out why the platform is so uniquely positioned as the global town square. Because if you can have Trump and Elon on a space and this thing gets, you know, with us covering it and everybody else covering it and the pieces of content that's going to be created, potentially hundreds of millions of views within 24 hours in all kinds of formats, probably more, honestly, then it becomes like, what is legacy media doing in response to this? Nothing. They can't. They don't have the scale or the technology to be able to compete with something like this.
Well, I mean, they will do what they normally do. You know, this is, I loved SMR's tweet about this. And for the next 24 hours, 48 hours, you know, 1 week after that, they're going to be Elon bad, Orange Man bad, so much bad, just bad, bad, bad. Like, that's all you're going to hear from legacy media for, and it's going to be so loud, like it's going to be insane. For,
I have a different prediction.
A while. Okay, let's hear it.
I don't think they cover it at all. I think they pretend it doesn't exist. Yeah, because I think the quality of discourse is going to be higher than people think. You know, I think what I was impressed by with Trump, even though I am not a fan of his, and I won't, you know, I'm not going to be voting for the guy. When he went on All In, it's like, okay, wow, I actually got your policy. Like, I actually understand where you're coming from with some of the ideas. I disagree with some of them, but like, I get it now. Like, I get how you're thinking about what you're trying to do. Whereas in any other format, you don't get that. So I think this is going to be similar to that. I could be 100% wrong. And I think that's a positive for discourse.
I think you're 120% wrong. For the simple fact that, yeah, well, two things. And you're going to change your position. I guarantee
you. Okay.
Trump makes people so mad that they can't help but talk about it. Journalists in particular, they're going to be so pissed off that they're not going to be able to contain not writing their opinion pieces about how awful and bad it was. But B, you're you said it yourself. There's going to be hundreds of millions of eyeballs looking for this content, and they can't not feed into the media frenzy and participate in the clicks and make their money.
Okay, so then why didn't they run with the his appearance on All In? I didn't see any coverage of that on mainstream media.
That's a good question.
I know the answer. Because it's actually high quality, like there's substance. Mainstream media doesn't do well when there's substance. Because there's like there's nothing they can grab onto that says, oh, look at how crazy this was. You should go back and listen to the original source. And the last thing they'll want to do is send traffic to X. Especially now, with like Elon's rhetoric and how much noise he's making. You know, unless there's literally something in there, like I would agree with you 1,000% if there's something in there. See, now I'm changing my mind, because I think if you pull up randos up there, you're going to get a good chance of somebody saying some crazy shit.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, they haven't done quite enough hit pieces on All In yet. Like, they haven't run the smear campaign.
Nobody knows
on
All In.
It's a combination of no one knows them, or if they do know them, they respect them. You know, like All In doesn't have a huge following of people who just hate All In yet. Or at least not that I've seen. And so I think that's different for Elon and Trump. Like, an Elon Trump conversation is like persona non grata plus persona non grata equals like hair on fire. Yeah. Well, yeah. So the trend stacking of the two names, obviously that's huge. You know, like Trump goes on All In. If you post that as your headline, like Trump is the only pull in that thing to 99% of readers, not that many, you know, even though they do well compared to Trump, like name recognition of All In podcast versus Trump is two dramatically different things. And like maybe the only name that is more recognizable than Trump is Elon Musk. So that is a whole different
level.
Let
me check. I'm actually curious now. Google Trends.
I'll bet you Trump is more, has a higher name recognition than.
Okay, let's verify that. Let's see.
I've looked at this recently, and they have gone back and forth over the last 30 days of who is more searched.
Okay, so I'm gonna do Donald Trump. And I'm gonna do Elon Musk. I'm gonna do the last 90 days. Oh yeah, Trump by a lot. Well, he also got shot there.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not fair. Let's go. He's got an unfair advantage. He got shot at.
Is that what Elon's doing wrong? He's not letting any of his would-be assassins shoot at him.
Jeez, that's so dark. Yeah, Trump definitely pulls more. But I mean, you're right. I mean, Elon Musk interviews Donald Trump. That is the mother of all SEOs right there. Yeah. It just needs to be as simple as that. So, David, if you're watching this, that's the title. Yeah.
So, question for you. Does Trump make his permanent comeback to X after having a conversation with Elon Musk? Or does he stay only on Truth Social?
I think he stays only on Truth Social until that website goes away. In some way. I don't think that's going to be a long-term website. Like, are they even getting more users? I don't even know what Truth Social is. I've never been on it. It feels like a massive echo chamber, you know? Like, that's what it's like the right-wing
threads. The only thing worse than Threads.
You know? It's like Threads is a competitor to Truth Social, and X is in the middle somewhere, you know? I think there's a chance he might. I think it probably helps him. What's been interesting tracking this election is, I think after the Democrats made the switch to Kamala Harris, I mean, she's definitely has picked up a lot of momentum from everybody who just hates Trump. Like, I think a lot of folks that just want to vote for anybody but Trump, so to ensure that Trump doesn't get elected, and they will leverage the Democratic Party to do that. I think Kamala has brought back a lot of that enthusiasm where they found somebody that can do that for them, you know? And so I think it's in Trump's best interest to keep engaged in as many different fronts as possible so that there isn't too much momentum going into the debates in September where he can't recover. But my understanding is that there's at least one debate that they agreed to, which was on the 10th of September. And there's, I think, two more that was confirmed, the 3rd and the 25th, maybe, if I'm thinking about the dates correctly, in September on ABC, Fox, and one other one. I think this dynamic changes entirely after the debates, because I think if I think about how Kamala Harris performed back in 2020 when she ran for president, you know, she got
Stand up to Tulsi Gabbard, yeah. like Trump is going to bury her. It's going to be
ugly,
comical.
Yeah. And it's not so much that I want to say Trump is like an excellent debater. Trump just knows how to just Teflon, you know, Teflon Don. They call him Teflon. He's
unfazed. They call it a debate, but it's not a debate. It is a roast. And like, you know, the point of a roast is to make people, like, whoever can make people laugh with the best insults is the winner. And, you know, there's no way that she even stands a chance in that scenario.
Politics in 2024 in the United States. This is how we elect our leaders. It's who can make the other one, who can make the audience laugh the most. We deserve what we get. It's so sad.
It almost makes me feel as bad as the Brits must feel right now with all of their insanity.
How crazy is that? I was talking to my wife about that in the car, dude. Like, I don't know if you guys are aware that are watching this podcast. There was a post from the UK government, right? UK Gov, where gov.uk, official X channel of the government UK website. And there was a post they made where it was in relation to some of the, actually directly in relation to some of the riots and upheaval that's happening in the UK. And folks from the UK that watched this, I would love to hear your commentary in the comment section below, because we're obviously across the pond. And our media guy, David, who is from the UK, the south of England, has been on vacation for like 1,000 years this summer. And he doesn't have boots on the ground, so we can't even get his gauge. But there was, you know, they've been making some noise around, hey, you know, content that incites violence or hatred isn't just harmful, it can be illegal. And so, you know, the UK has this law essentially that you can go to jail for saying or posting the wrong thing on social media. And then they made this post where it said, think before you post, right? And this post has been getting roasted, primarily from Greg. I was going to try to ratio you, but decided not to because it might be illegal and I don't want to get in trouble. And boy, did they get ratioed. But just a lot of people, you know, 1776 is looking better by the day. Think before you become North Korea, so on and so forth. So a lot of Americans like myself feel that this is made in a very, it's like a very strange way of approaching this, because you're basically saying, hey, if you're, let's say in the best case scenario, you're uninformed and say you post the wrong thing that is not common knowledge in that country and the government deems that as dangerous, you can just go to jail for not knowing enough. That's crazy to me. Like, you're punishing people that are not as informed as the government wants them to be.
And the place where this gets real uncomfortable real fast is for people who, like the Jay Bhattacharyas of the world, who were definitely labeled as wrong think, not allowed to speak, don't say this, and turned out to be correct, that saying things that are inconvenient to the people who are pulling the strings is one of the things. Like, if there was faith that the government in the UK would only exercise this power to prosecute actual incitement to violence, I don't think the pushback would be what it is. But the problem is that we all know, like, you know, no one believes that, like, once the government has the power to punish social media users for the things that they say online, of course that power is going to be abused. Like, what, you think that you're going to give them, you know, social media nukes and expect them not to use them? Come on. And I mean, that's the thing here, is that we all know that it's saying the things that are true and need to be spoken that the government does not want to hear is the thing that will get you most punished under this law, which is why it is getting this incredible amount of pushback.
And so here's the thing, right? This is where for us that follow the Elon Musk space as closely as we do, the main thing that I've been hearing a lot of from people that are very upset with Elon, with like the rhetoric he's taking, that is like, you know, his has been like freedom of speech is the most important thing. There are countries and people actively out there trying to destroy civilization by putting in draconian measures, right? A lot of people might say this is crazy, like he's being unrealistic, he's taking it too far, his rhetoric's crazy. But then you read stuff like that from the UK government, you're like, okay, shit, well, yeah, this is, he's kind of got a point. He's kind of got a point. And, you know, and nobody's perfect and nobody has it nailed 100% of the time. But when you're thinking about something as fundamental and as what's the word I'm looking for here? As
existential?
Existential. Thank you. As freedom of speech, and now with the advent of technology and social media, governments can now go on your Facebook page and then find a post where you said something wrong, and then they can throw you in jail for it. Can't have it. Can't have it. The United States was founded specifically on that premise, where people ran away from governments that would unfairly subjugate the people. And the country was founded on saying, we will not stand for this, right? And it's crazy to see that it's still happening in Western nations. Like, you know, like free speech is not a right in the UK. Free speech is not a right in Canada. And it's in a lot of countries.
Or Australia.
Yep. Like freedom of speech is not a part of the laws, which means that if you just say the wrong thing based on how the government feels about that thing, you can be in jail. It's insane. It's crazy.
Yeah. And you see rhetoric by people, whether it's the Supreme Court judge in somewhere in South America, I think it's Brazil potentially, who has talked about wanting to hold Elon Musk accountable for allowing all these unsayable things to be said on social media in their country. Or now we're hearing the same types of rhetoric coming out of people in the government in the UK. We've heard it before from people in the government in Australia.
President of Venezuela.
Yeah, that's right. Maduro. Yep. No, there's somebody else that I'm thinking of who was, he was on the Supreme
You're thinking
Court
of the somewhere. Of the Supreme Court guy from in Brazil, the guy looks like Lex Luthor or whatever.
Yes,
he that looked guy. Like that evil guy with like his black coat.
Yep. These types of tyrants, of course, do not want people to be able to speak up and say, hey, Mr. Tyrant, you're a tyrant and we're not going to stand for that.
100%. And I gotta go here in a couple minutes. But what I find really ironic about this whole conversation is we're talking about the UK. My wife just brought me some wonderful British tea. And so all I'm gonna say is watch me dump this in the sea. Screw your laws, screw your taxes. Just kidding. I love people from the UK. I love the UK. It's crazy. I mean, it's a mad world that we live in. There's a lot of crazy rhetoric out there, but some of it is justified. And like, instead of just deeming everything as crazy, I think it's what's always best is to test it. Like test the things that are being said or test the things that you're seeing. Just go out and see if you can find those situations. Go back and watch the full discussions, you know? So when I read this thing about the UK and the freedom, I'm like, okay, let me hear it directly from the source. No, there's definitely police. There was a police officer in the UK that was saying, they were talking about Elon Musk saying, you know, UK is on the verge of civil war or whatever, you know? Which I disagree. I don't think they're on the verge of civil war. I think if they keep going down this path for a long time and it goes unchecked, terrible things will happen for sure. But I don't think they're on the verge, right? But the cop was basically saying, you know, that there could be grounds for us to extradite him and arrest him for inciting chaos in the UK. I'm like, okay, that's crazy. But anyway.
Well, I'm going to you know, violate the UK's laws on incitement to free speech by quoting Thomas Jefferson. From time to time, the tree of liberty must be refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants.
All right. Hopefully we don't get demonetized. Dude, are you citing violence, Hans, right now? My God. You totally just incited violence.
Obviously. No, I love the Jordan Peterson phrase, too, that we could bring in here that speaks to what you were saying. He says that it is one of the reasons that free speech is so important is that we need to put our ideas to the test so that our ideas can die instead of us. And I would much, much rather see the ideas of tyrants be put to death, you know, in the public square of conversation and debate and social discourse than for it actually to come to violence in the physical world. And the same thing, like, man, the ideas of patriots, there are a lot of patriotic ideas that are actually self-destructive, and those need to be tested and shaped and molded and improved. And that happens through, you know, discourse and trial and error. And I think that that's also a much better way, you know, for us to converge to the most optimal solutions that are good for the health of society in general, you know, people, humanity, not just existing power structures in governments or vested interests.
It's the only way. I don't think there's any other way. Every other way leads the opposite way. It's not like I feel like it's not really a spectrum of like it's like 0 to 1. Like if you don't have that, you're going to trend towards tyranny. If you have freedom of speech and you're able to talk about all the ideas, however uncomfortable or quote unquote risky it may seem, that is the mechanism that gets you to prosperity and people being able to live free lives. It's just uncomfortable and painful. And it feels scary because for some reason, our society today is at scale. Doesn't want to partake or is afraid to out of fear of being ostracized. But that's also part of our DNA because, you know, we're tribal people. We don't want to offend people, so on and so forth. So we have a lot of things working against us, but the mechanism of freedom of speech is so important. It truly is. And I think now more than ever, we can see why.
So. Well, one final very spicy take to end the conversation on. I would like for people who do live in the UK who are shocked by the ability of the government to do what they're doing, to rob citizens of their right to just, you know, live normal lives. And, you know, if you're not hurting anyone, to express ideas that the government doesn't agree with. This is exactly why the founding fathers included the Second Amendment in the United States, that if the police had to contend with the fact that you might be armed when they came into your home to arrest you on something so trivial, the bar for invading your privacy and trying to steal your rights becomes much, much higher. And while under normal circumstances, it seems like that right is not all that meaningful, when things go sideways, which they will eventually, the importance of that right becomes all too apparent all too quickly, but usually in a way that it's far too little, far too late.
I have a hard time trusting large bodies that are inherently inefficient and incapable of doing the right thing most of the time. And if you let that go for long enough, you'll end up with a terrible spot. And so,
well, and just with the hypocrisy that large, inefficient, susceptible to capture entity, let's make sure that they have all the guns and we have none.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Wonderful. Honestly, I don't even know where to go with this. You might have to edit this out because I haven't fully formed this thought.
All right. Hopefully we don't get demonetized. Screw your laws. Screw your taxes. Just kidding.